significant degree of political power. We'll see what emerges from this trial.
And we're going to talk more about this in these coming days. And also remember that President Trump just pardoned the convicted narco-trafficker, Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Programming is supported by Mutual Management Company. Mutual Management offers housing in Riverside Homes, a collection of vintage, low-density properties in the heart of the Riverside neighborhood. These homes feature unique layouts, strong connections to outdoor spaces, and the opportunity to build community within this vibrant area. Since 1980, Riverside Homes has helped preserve the character of this critical neighborhood. Learn more or explore available housing by contacting Mutual Management, MutualMGMTCompany.com, or by calling 612-333-9164. Make Riverside Homes your next home.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and around the world at kfai.org. The community's true voice.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. I'm your host, Michael Whetstone. Thank you very much for tuning in and for your continued support of KFAI. Today on the program, we are going to be airing Mini Culture's Year in Review for the year that was 2025. A big award-winning year with big changes, too, as we welcomed our terrific new director in Erica Yannick. In fact, since there has been such great work, such a huge amount of great new work, we are going to keep on that theme, Mini Culture's Year in Review, for the entire month. By my count, Mini Culture created nearly 30 new stories this year and another full season of podcast episodes, all chocked full of Minnesota arts, culture, and history, and award-winning, too. Once again, we had pieces take home MNSPJ Page One Awards. You can find Mini Culture's work at KFAI.org under the Mini Culture tab or by visiting their SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/miniculture. And you can, of course, hear the podcast episodes wherever you like to listen to podcasts. It can be found in all the major and even minor outlets. 9 seasons now, and I'm sure another one is in production as I speak. Audio documentaries exploring Minnesota's arts, culture, and history. Stories about musical sensations, small town heroes, cultural icons, local lore, and a whole bunch more. Mini Culture is created by audio producers from all around our great state. Come back in the following weeks, and I do hope to give Season 9 another spin right here on Mini Culture Presents as we continue the year in review. But right now, we are going to peruse the stacks and play a number of stories from this year. Mini Culture's award-winning team of producers are helped with editing, guidance, and expertise from our director and executive producers, Julie Sansulo and Erica Yannick. And today we're going to hear stories from a slew of brilliant creators. At the top of the show, we're going to the Twin Cities Pride Festival to get the lowdown on the Pride's history and the folks who shaped it. After that, we'll hop on the nostalgia train with Arme Rivard as she revisits the Lunch with Casey television program. Then we're going to drastically shift gears and learn about forensic investigators adhering to what has become known as the Minnesota Protocol, a set of guidelines for examining suspicious deaths. Then, after the break, in the second half of the show, we're going to hear about a few remarkable Minnesota women. First, television producer Toni Hughes, an African-American woman and the first to appear regularly on weeknight newscasts in Minnesota. Then we'll also hear an audio portrait of Halima Osman, a Somali immigrant here in Minnesota. And then another Listen to Your Elders spot, a portrait of Tamika Jones. But first, we remember Ashley Rooks, the namesake of the Twin Cities Pride Parade, here on Mini Culture Presents Mini Culture's Year in Review for 2025.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. In 1993, a transgender woman named Ashley Ann Rooks took over as the director of the Twin Cities Pride Parade, and she changed the parade forever. KFAI's Dixie Treichel shares this story.
Each year, thousands of people line the streets for the Ashley Rooks GLBT Pride Parade. But who was Ashley Rooks? And why is the parade named after her? Ashley Ann Rooks, a transgender woman, loved parades ever since she was a child. Her enthusiasm for pageantry and community inspired her to become involved with parades as an adult. Ashley became the Aquitennial Grand Day Parade Chair for a year and gained experience in organizing a parade on a large scale. Preferring to work with the LGBTQ community, she turned towards the Twin Cities Pride Parade, an event she found politically and spiritually significant. And in 1990, she started working with Twin Cities Pride. Seeing how the parade could be improved, she knew there was more to be done. The turning point for Ashley and the Twin Cities Pride Parade came in 1993, when with her organizing skills and experience, she took full command of the parade. Anne DeGroot. She was a colleague of Ashley Rooks.
I knew Ashley when I was the executive director of Outfront Minnesota, and Ashley was on our board of directors. Ashley was a very kind person, a very community-oriented person, and Ashley brought to our LGBTQ community her skills and her expertise as a parade organizer from the Aquitennial, and she professionalized the Pride Parade.
Archivist Stuart Van Cleve in 2011, talking about Ashley when he was the historian for the Twin Cities Pride Committee.
In 1992, she went to the Twin Cities Pride, saw the parade, and was horrified at how disorganized it was. So then 1993 rolls around, and she sends this letter that's called Stuff About Your Parade, and it basically just completely critiqued everything about the parade. She hated it. It was all wrong. And so she decided that she was the only person who could fix this. And the theme of 1993 was a family of pride. The idea was is that you were going to get the whole family together, all the different groups, and have them all have a voice and be represented.
This is Ashley Rooks in an interview with historian Scott Paulson in October 1993.
When I started working with the Pride Festival, the parade had traditionally been rather a free-for-all. The lineup on that street on Sunday morning, first come, first to march. In the past several years, we've organized ourselves. We set ourselves all down on paper. We know who one another are. I love this.
People would see Ashley riding her magnificent red tricycle up and down the parade route, making sure everything was in order. They loved her no-nonsense approach and community-oriented spirit. Brad Tyson was a host with Green and Yellow TV. Here he is broadcasting live at the 1993 Twin Cities Pride Parade.
Here's Ashley Rooks on the bike. She put on today's parade. She's the number one head cheese. There's Ashley. Really good. Thanks for asking.
Ashley was a maverick at producing parades that broke barriers. Her parades became more inclusive with trans visibility, a variety of ages and cultures, and brought LGBTQ plus people and allies together in solidarity and celebration. Here's Ashley again in October 1993.
District 202, for instance, this was a big deal, and that's the first time youth had ever been in that parade. For the first time, there were two groups of Southeast Asians and East Asian and Polynesian individuals were bringing people of color, a multicultural attitude into our home. I think that's positive stuff.
I like the way that Ashley Rooks has the parade put together this year. People of similar interests, their units kind of follow each other.
During her time as parade director, Ashley expanded 30 units in 1992 into 270 units in 2000, making the Twin Cities Pride Parade the largest of any kind in Minnesota and the surrounding states. In June 2000, just a week before the Twin Cities Pride Parade, Ashley passed away unexpectedly at the age of 52. Here's Anne DeGroot again.
It was shocking to us when she died. I remember being at the Outfront office at the time, and we got a phone call. We were stunned. Ashley really left an impact.
The 2000 Twin Cities Pride Committee decided to name the parade in Ashley's honor, the Ashley Rooks GLBT Pride Parade, as it is still known today in 2025. Ashley Rooks is one of the most significant figures in Twin Cities Pride history.
She had this penchant for wearing like militaristic clothing, and so she was just this total presence. She would command and they would follow. Her era was probably the best in terms of parades.
This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI.
This story was written and produced by Dixie Treichel. Archival audio in this program is courtesy of the Treader Collection in GLBT Studies at the Minnesota Historical Society and KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE. If you grew up in the Twin Cities in the 1950s, you may remember a popular broadcast on Channel 11 called Lunch with Casey. The show was written and produced explicitly for children to watch during lunchtime. KFAI's Armé Rivard reflects on a show that defined her childhood.
Oh my gosh, wow, it's Lunch with Casey. I haven't thought of that show in years.
Well, hi, gang, your old buddy Casey Jones. Once again, and according to my trusty old Redwood watch, we're right on time and all set for a good day. Nice to have you here with us. Are you hungry? Well, so am I. Let's get over and see what we have for lunch today. Let's go.
The Lunch with Casey show opened with a clip of a train yard with an old steam engine chugging along with the host of the show, Casey Jones, waving out the window. My siblings and I would hear this theme song and come running to have our lunch in front of the television set with Casey Jones and his sidekick, Roundhouse Rodney. The show debuted in May 1954 and aired for close to 20 years. High noon on WTCN-TV, Channel 11. The show's appeal ranged from preschoolers to grade schoolers. My friend Ann Webner remembers the show fondly.
I remember coming home from kindergarten and my mom would set me up in front of Casey Jones with my Campbell's vegetable soup and peanut butter sandwich, and that was our little daily ritual, my lunch in front of Casey Jones.
Casey Jones was played by actor Roger Awesome. Here is Roger in character of Casey Jones describing one of the crazy personalities they featured on the program.
One of the characters we had on the program was Oswald. His real name was Oswald McGum. And Oswald was a character created which had the body of a man upside down, and it would come over the nose. And then this part of the face from here on painted some eyes here, and then the mouth was a regular mouth. And then we had to flip the camera upside down, and then it would look like a puppet, only a real live one. For some reason, little children were frightened by Oswald.
Oswald here, Oswald McGum. And say, do you hear about the elephant that swallowed a spoon? Well, he hasn't stirred since.
I loved Oswald.
That's my sister Elaine Rivard.
It took me a really long time to figure out that Oswald was Roundhouse's chin. I mean, who would have guessed?
The clever choice of material that inspired the antics of Casey and Roundhouse can still tickle my funny bone, too. In the early years of the program, Roger Awesome and Lynn Dwyer, who played Roundhouse Rodney, wrote and produced the shows with the help of their director, Al DeRuscia. The show aired live, and the personable approach of their characters addressing their young audience while eating lunch proved to be engaging for all the kids who got to join him with their lunch in front of the TV. The show aired in the Twin Cities metro area, and on a good day, the viewers in Duluth could catch the show with a little adjustment of the rabbit ears. Lunch with Casey ran some of the most popular cartoons of the day during the breaks of the show, Looney Tunes, Hanna-Barbera, and Gumby.
One of the most fun songs that we did was I put on a pair of long red underwear, put on a big mustache, and we did this song. Do you remember Walking in My Winter Underwear?
Sleigh bells ring and I'm listening, but I'm turning and twisting, 'cause I'm itching up here and I'm scratching down there, walking in my winter underwear.
I have no idea where they found all these funny songs that they lip-sync to in their skits.
Here's the show's director, Al DeRuscia, demystifying one of my favorite skits.
The idea, well, let's turn the set upside down, but let's hang the set from the ceiling so that when the picture is upside down, the set is upright.
I did it. I turned everything upside down.
Yeah, but did you ever try to eat a bowl of soup upside down?
That's pretty cool. How'd they do that, you know? They turned a whole room upside down. Did you try to figure out how it was done? No, I literally believe that they had turned the room upside down.
The most popular segment of the program was the Daily Birthday Song, sung by Casey Jones.
They did the Happy Birthday Song. I thought that was pretty cool, the way that they, you know, wished everybody a happy birthday, and then you got to have your name on the air. It was happy, happy birthday to every girl and boy.
Hope this very special day brings you lots of joy. Hope this birthday present you get from mom and dad will make this very special day the best you've ever had.
And maybe that's a good place to close our program for today. Well, I'm your old buddy Casey Jones, and better check my trusty old Redwood watch. Hey, we're all out of time, but I hope I'll see you around in many different places around our beautiful state. So this is your old buddy Casey Jones saying, so long, gang!
This story was written and produced by Armay Rivard. Archival audio of the Lunch with Casey show is courtesy of CARE TV, Channel 11. You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE. We'll be right back.
listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Have you ever heard of the Minnesota Protocol? It's a set of international guidelines used by the United Nations when a government is suspected of being involved. You may have never heard of the protocol, but forensic experts around the world have carried copies in their back pockets for years. KFAI's Michelle Brook tells this story.
Forensic investigators are looking for unmarked graves in South Africa. They're investigating murders from the apartheid era of 1948 to 1994, when racial segregation was law.
Police have rounded up more than 900 black leaders and suspected leaders and opened fire on angry stone-throwing crowds. That appears to have restored...
Over 600 people have died already, and hundreds more have disappeared. People are dying.
That was Dumisani Khumalo of the U.S. Committee on Africa.
The South African government created the Missing Persons Task Team in 2005 to locate secret burial sites, identify remains, and return bodies to families. They use the international gold standard for death investigations. This gold standard is called the Minnesota Protocol.
It's such an interesting piece of Minnesota history that not very many people know about.
This is Jennifer Prestholt from the Advocates for Human Rights in Minneapolis.
I go around the world and people are like, oh, Minnesota, do you know the Minnesota Protocol?
The Minnesota Protocol is used for investigating suspicious deaths. It comes into play when a government is suspected of unlawful killing, or someone dies in prison, or when people disappear and the state never investigates. The protocol has been adopted by the United Nations.
Excellency.
This is a 2024 meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Speaking now is the representative from Brazil.
Implementation of the Minnesota Protocol. Additionally, we express our appreciation for your support in promoting the Portuguese language version of the protocol. Thank you.
It all started in 1983 when a group of Minnesota lawyers formed a committee to volunteer on international human rights issues. Barbara Fry was one of them.
We were just committed that we were going to do this.
At that time, the human rights community was alarmed by the assassination of opposition leader Benigno Aquino in the Philippines.
Newsweek on air. The murder of Aquino, despite a small army of soldiers supposedly guarding him at the airport in Manila, left the opposition shaken and leaderless, but it also cast a cloud of suspicion over the government of President Ferdinand Marcos, and it raised some old questions about...
We all knew that when... then-President Ferdinand Marcos said that there would be a thorough investigation when it was pretty obvious that the government had authorized the assassination, that there was really no standard against which to judge what was going to be a good investigation.
That meant governments could get away with murder and never expect to face accountability from anyone.
If someone committed mass murder, the most we could hope for is that they would be exiled, some villa in France or Saudi Arabia. Those were always seemed to be where people went, you know. And the thought of holding high-level violators accountable was just impossible.
But the United Nations wanted to somehow address political killings. And the growing use of forensic science made it possible to investigate crimes long after death. Barb's mentor, the late University of Minnesota professor David Weisbrod, thought the volunteer lawyers could take this on. They could bring people together to create international standards for a good death investigation. Barb tried her best to raise money for airfare so they could fly in global experts.
I sort of laugh when I look back at it. I probably had a stack of request letters, you know, an inch thick. Finally, David, through his contacts at the UN, got the Danish government to donate $10,000.
They booked a West Metro Conference Center in 1987 and brought in people from the UN and experts like Dr. Clyde Snow, whose forensic testimony in Argentina helped convict generals of human rights violations.
They're a colorful lot. These guys, when they get talking shop, you know, they're talking about like what it's like to investigate plane crashes and never travel with a pen in your pocket because if you're crashed, the impact of the pen will kill you. And so it made it super fun to work on this case because the personalities involved, like, they were bigger than life.
First, they drafted a set of principles. Investigations must be prompt, thorough, independent, impartial, and transparent. This was exactly what the UN was looking for. Next, with Hennepin County, they created a mince and analyzed skeletal remains. It's been used in countries including Rwanda, Bosnia, Guatemala, and more.
Every country has a law against murder. The question is, what happens when someone is murdered? How do you investigate? I think of it always as a measuring stick to judge whether their investigation is enough.
That pro bono lawyers committee went on to become the Advocates for Human Rights, which has worked on all kinds of cases. They worked with Peru's Truth and Reconciliation Commission to uncover the truth about violence during the 80s and 90s, when subversive groups massacred families, and young men suspected of being terrorists disappeared. The commission exhumed mass grave sites in 2002.
In Peru, I met with some of the mothers of the disappeared.
This is Jennifer Prestholt.
They just kept saying to us, we just want to know what happened to our sons. You know, we just want to know where they are. And so the fact that they were able to use the Minnesota Protocol to do an effective investigation and exhumation and return those bodies is a really, really important thing.
In the beginning, the name Minnesota Protocol was just a nickname, but the UN made it official when they revised the standards in 2016, partly because the name stuck and partly to recognize the groundbreaking work of the original drafters. This time, the meeting took place at the UN in Geneva.
It is like a palace. It's giant marble, you know, very grand. But because we were working on the weekend, there was nobody there. You know, so I've been in these buildings a lot, but it was kind of weird to be there, you know, behind the doors.
Behind the doors, Minnesota still had an outsized seat at the table, including Minnesotans who'd worked on the protocol the first time around. They added procedures for DNA analysis, making it possible to identify very old and small samples of human tissue. New guiding principles included the rights of victims' families and the rights of society as a whole.
The right for society to know the truth about what happened in order to prevent that from happening again.
Of course, countries don't always defer to international institutions, including the United States. Here's Barb Fry.
I believe that eras like this one, where we're having huge challenges in getting states to hold other states accountable for terrible crimes, that the most important thing to do is to document and preserve evidence, preserve stories. It may not feel like you can change things today, but it really will help either in accountability terms or at least in memory terms in the future so that people can learn from the violations that are taking place at any given moment.
Barb Fry used to feel extremely frustrated sitting at United Nations meetings, watching the wheels of justice move so slowly. But now, she's watched the Minnesota Protocol grow from an idea to a global field manual. She's seen the impact of truth commissions and trials 40 years after the crimes. She's seen what happens when people don't give up.
Victims and families of victims pretty much never forget, and they never stop advocating for accountability.
This is Michelle Brook for KFAI.
Listening to a radio station like no other. Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, supported by generous listener members just like you. So please do your part and what was the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Today's episode of Mini Culture Presents is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the good people of Minnesota. If you are enjoying today's stories, I strongly recommend that you subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, which you can find wherever you enjoy listening to your favorite podcasts. It is chock full of great arts, history, and culture stories about our wonderful state. You can find it on SoundCloud and KFEI.org. Under the Mini Culture tab, you can also re-listen to, find, and share each of these stories that you've heard today individually on Mini Culture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about a few remarkable Minnesota women. First, television pioneer Toni Hughes, an African-American woman, the first to appear regularly on our television sets as part of the weeknight newscasts in Minnesota. Also, a pair of Listen to Your Elders portraits by Sundas Hassan Nooley as we continue presenting Miniculture Year in Review 2025 right here on Miniculture Presents in just a moment. Stick around.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. If this were an actual emergency, the tones you just heard would be followed by information and further instructions. This concludes the test of the emergency alert system.
Support for KFAI comes from the Dakota, presenting the Yellow Jackets, Wednesday, January 21st. For 44 years, the Yellow Jackets have brought rock, fusion, and R&B to the world of jazz. The hallmark of the Yellow Jackets have always been exploration and reinvention. To their true nature, their latest release, Fasten Up, continues that tradition. The Yellow Jackets are all about self-discovery, continuing their jazz journey while challenging themselves along the way. More information about the Yellow Jackets at the Dakota is available at dakotacooks.com.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. For 10 years, beginning in 1969, Toni Hughes reported the weather on Twin Cities WTCN-TV, which is now Care 11. Like most TV weather reporters at the time, she was never an accredited meteorologist. But as a model and a dancer, she looked and sounded great on camera, and she raised viewership and ratings. Hiring Toni Hughes was a bold move for the time because she was African American, the first Black woman to appear regularly on weeknight newscasts in Minnesota. KFAI producer Allison Young brings us her story.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap.
I happen to believe that women need to come forth much more forcefully at this juncture and assume a much more important role.
The year was 1969. A time in the United States of tremendous social upheaval. People of color were finally gaining equal rights, and women were joining the workforce in droves. And it was that same year, 1969, that a TV station in Minnesota, WTCN, was about to make history.
And the weather for it all, a little bit cooler, eh?
A little bit cooler, but it's not really too bad for the season of the year.
WTCN, which would later become Care 11, hired the first Black woman to join their news lineup in the state. And that woman's name was Toni Hughes.
She had an effervescent personality, and everything that she touched kind of drew people to her. And her being the first Black on-air talent in the Twin Cities was really a big, big deal at the time.
Toni's sister, Shirley Hughes, remembers well the beautiful, charismatic, and in her words, Renaissance woman who took to the air every weeknight for 10 years to read the weather to Minnesotans. Toni Hughes was a graduate of St. Kate's and worked as a nurse at the University of Minnesota School of Epidemiology. But she also had an artistic bent. Slender and graceful with a warm smile, she gigged as a model and a dancer. In fact, it was the founder of Minnesota Dance Theater, Lois Holton, who suggested Tony audition for the job of weather girl at WTCN.
It's interesting. She was a model, and she was a social model as well. Modeling in terms of being the first and being very aware of what she represented in terms of sort of carrying Black people, the Black community as well.
Tony's daughter, Roxanne Allen, reminds us that in those days, success was judged more on someone's look, their style, and their ability to connect with the viewer than any specific expertise. Even though Tony Hughes didn't have any training as a meteorologist, she took to her weather reporting quickly.
The Minnesota area snow flurries for the northern.
Now, this was a time before we had weather modeling or prediction tools like Doppler radar. So every weeknight, she would pull and review weather information from tear sheets fresh off a national wire. And she used this information to manually set up a rudimentary weather board. Over her tenure, Tony was at first separated on the set from the rest of the news team. Later, she sat with her co-hosts, gaining, quite literally, a seat at the table.
She went from a transition of weather girl to weather woman to weather reporter. So as the times changed, and remember, we need to think about the times in terms of women's rights, civil rights, technology was changing, news was changing. All of these things converged at the same time. But she grew as the times grew as well.
Tony Hughes' social influence was not limited to the Black community. She received fan mail from far and wide, including from curious out-of-staters with cabins in the Northland, wanting to keep a finger on the pulse of local weather. In July of 1976, Minneapolis TV Guide published an article called Two Minneapolis Newsrooms. A picture of WTCN's news team, including Tony Hughes, sits on one side, looking over at the cast of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. The caption underneath reads, in the real one, they don't have to be funny once a week. Still, Roxanne points out that being the first woman and person of color on TV news put a tremendous amount of pressure on Tony to be as close to perfect as possible.
And my mom was always aware, and we were always aware as kids, of being on your best behavior, you know, giving your best presentation, because you just don't get second chances when you're a woman or a person of color, especially back then.
Even though Tony Hughes' position was prominent at a time of social change, she was considered a freelance contract employee, working only 3 hours each night and earning around $100 each week. All of this was happening while she was getting a divorce and raising two children as a single mom. By the late 70s, news stations around the country were battling it out for the number one slot. When WTCN transitioned to an NBC affiliate, it got caught up in the so-called news wars. Those in charge felt compelled to follow the trend of hiring a professional meteorologist to present the weather. Just a few months short of earning her American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or AFTRA, credential, Tony Hughes was sent a two-sentence letter terminating her employment without severance or any offer to continue working at the station in another capacity.
But as I recall, she didn't dwell on that. She was the kind of person, okay, if this door is closing, then I've got to figure out some other doors to open up. What's the next chapter I've got to create?
In time, other doors did open, and she moved to San Francisco to become director of medical management at Cigna Healthcare. In 2000, Tony Hughes died of multiple myeloma. She was only 62. But her trailblazing career as the first Black on-air talent to regularly appear as part of a Minnesota weekday newscast made a mark.
I know that seeing my mom influenced other people to know that they too could be that or more. We have come far, we've got farther to go, but we need to remember the people who sort of broke ground for us to get to where we are now.
So well said.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE. are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. We're all taught to listen to our elders, especially to our grandmothers, our aunties, and generally the wise women in our communities and neighborhoods. Today, audio producer Sundas Hasanuli shares the story of the most influential and wise woman that she knows, her own mother, Halima Osman.
The grandma hypothesis is an evolutionary theory that older women play an essential role in the community's reproductive health, and some would go as far as to say that helps explain why human women in particular live long past their reproductive years. The grandma hypothesis was first proposed by American evolutionary biologist George Christopher Williams in his landmark 1957 paper, Pleiotropy, Natural Selection, and the Evolution of Senescence. In other words, Williams was looking at biological aging. He asserted that at some point in our human evolution, it became advantageous for older women and grandmothers to stop reproducing and instead redirect their energy towards raising and supporting the next generation. He claimed that this conscious refocus not only ensured the survival of the woman's genes through her kin, but also increased her longevity. Williams' hypothesis instrumentally changed prevailing notions of aging, adaptation, and natural selection, and he was met with fierce criticism when he first published his hypothesis, and he's still met with the same criticism to this day. So, what's the criticism? People look towards lions, baboons, and other mammals and point to the fact that despite grandmotherly care, it doesn't necessarily ensure the survival of the grandchildren. However, I would say the grandmother hypothesis is still a compelling explanation as to why we, humans, and dolphins are the only species of mammals that have menopause in the animal kingdom. And I think it's good to imagine menopause evolve not as an ending, but as a beginning, a kind of strategy for our survival, a way to ensure your own kin, your neighbor's kin, and the community's children, all of us have the chance to thrive. To a degree, we as a species owe our survival to the knowledge and care of our elder women, whether that elder woman has children or not. This is about passing on important messages, keys, and memories in life. That's where we find Halima Osman, a Somali-American teacher assistant, community educator, and founder of Mother's Tutoring Academy, a nonprofit dedicated to closing the educational gap in the Twin Cities. She is a mother of four daughters, a math enthusiast, a Taurus son, and lived so many lives before the age of 40. This is part of Halima's story, in her own words. Let's take a listen.
My name Halima Osman. When I'm young, I grew up the place, all the people, they are parents. When you go running and do something, every mother and father say, stop and do that. That's where we grew up. And in the morning, I remember when I'm young, nobody says, wake up and do this. When I'm young, I wake up and you go to school and the teachers is different than the teachers now where they're doing it. I remember if you are one wrongdoing, they do a lot of punishment for that. We grew up for mother is not there, but we have amazing father that time. He is careful us. He go with us. I remember we go with him for the zoo, and I ask him many things. And one day we go to that museum in Somali, has they call Aqal Somali. And I grow that, and we have everything is for movie, school is they have everything is, and we learn about English, Arabic, and Italian language, and school is beautiful, beautiful life. After that, I finish in high school. The college name is La Folle, and I take my math and physics. I like that, and I finish. That time, I remember 10 boys and 2 girls. And the other girl, she say, I don't want a math. After that, the professor say, why you are here? If the girl drop up this glass, and I say, I want. When I finish, immediately war is coming.
The Somali Civil War began in the 1990s and inconclusively ended sometime in the mid-2010s. But the echo of war, trauma, and its memories still bleed in many Somali households in the diaspora. For many of us, the war haunts us like a familiar shadow. Whether conscious or not, a lot of the work we do in our culture is releasing grief. War, survivor's guilt, and responsibility of time may not weigh heavy in Halima's life anymore, but it's still a part of the story.
When war is coming, my life is changed immediately because I never see somebody died or the gunfire or everything. Some nights I'm not sleeping when I hear some bombing or something like that. After that, I'm running. I learn about how to survive because every day I remember this very, very, very problem for this. But I talk myself and I'm the that group for my family. I'm the biggest at that time. And I have the small sisters and I have brothers. And I say, okay, you see what you see. Your father's died. We have war. But if you are thinking you're crazy, what are you doing in the family? Go straight, don't back. When Somali is war, my sisters and my brother, they didn't have schools. Therefore, I don't like that. But I'm so interested because I started to teach how they write Somali language, how to write ABC, how they write math. And they tell me when they come for UK or they come Denmark, they say, every teacher say, how you learn this? And they say, my sister, they are teaching for the wartime. And when I come to the United States, I'm teaching too. I like to teach and help the people. If you look at this, you remember where you come from. But what I say, forget about like war, like something bad. But if you have forward, made good things. Sometimes I see war, everything is. But if I say every time the war, what happened, you forget your future. Dagaal qof baa ku dhinto inuu kuma dhasho waa maama Soomaalida kamid ah marka waxa wax kasta ka fiican intii la dagaali lahaa in nabad laga hadlo in laga hadlo sida loo wada noolaan lahaa in laga hadlo meeshan waxa ka dhacay in la xiliyo oo loo helo wax la sameeyo qof kasta waxaan ku waanin lahaa inaan nabad ka fikirto.
Thank you for listening. I'm honored to share the voice of Halima Usman, an incredible person living here in Minnesota, a pillar in our community, and one of the wisest women I know, my mother. In celebrating her story, we also honor a powerful idea that the wisdom and support we receive from the older women of our community is one of the most original ways we as humans receive and give care. Whether it's a personal gift, strength, or even duty, I'm grateful for all the women who brought me here today through their love and altruism, and I'm grateful to share this with you too. For KFAI, this is Sundas Hassanali.
You're listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Some people are a mama's boy, a daddy's girl, an auntie's angel, a dog's best friend. Tamika Jones is a grandma's gal. It was her grandmother's unconditional love that set her on the path of exploration and determination in starting her own business. KFAI's Sundas Hassanali shares this portrait of a woman whose dreams were supported and uplifted by her grandmother.
In my grandma's bathroom, she had this really old-time vanity, big mirror, lots of drawers, and in every single drawer, there was either rollers, hairpins, mascara, lipstick, because my grandma wore makeup. And so I would close the door to the bathroom, and she had a tape cassette, and I would turn on, and she only listened to gospel. And so I would turn on her music, and I would go through her drawers and just be like, ooh, what is that? Ooh, that lipstick color is cute. And she would come in, and she would not care that I was in her vanity. That really was impactful for me because that love that I felt in that space is what made me now have a lipstick company and be a makeup artist for all those years.
Elder women play an important role in our society, and I don't think they get enough credit for how much their truth-telling shapes our lives as a collective. I know this for sure, because I wouldn't be here without the elder women in my life. As a Somali-American woman whose family resettled in Minnesota because of war, it was the elder women who held the community together when our parents went out to work. They stayed home and told stories of yesteryear. With no certainty, no roadmap, they preserved our collective memories over tea and cookies. Whether it's around kitchen tables, porches, family dinners, or pictures in the photo album, we owe our survival to the countless older women who decided to sit down, tell a story, and encourage passion and thinking. Business owner Tamika Jones is a product of that kind of wisdom. Tamika's story starts long before her first lipstick sale, It begins with summers at her grandmother's house, learning, laughing, and being told that she could explore beauty without apology. That kind of love shapes a person. Now, we find Tamika, a proud owner of Lipesteem, a paraben-free and cruelty-free lipstick line made in the U.S. Her flagship store is located in the historic neighborhood of Rondo, on Selby Avenue, part of town where many African-American families moved to after the construction of Interstate 94 Highway, ripped through the Rondo district in the 50s and 60s. This is only part of Tamika's story. In her own words, let's take a listen.
My parents were about 21, 22 when they had me, and they were both very busy entrepreneurs and business people. And because my parents were really busy, we were raised by other people. My parents also eventually became pastors, and so they lived a middle-class life, and they wanted something different for their kids than they had. And so they ended up putting us in private schools, where we were one of the only Black children. And that was kind of strange, going to school with all white students, coming back to the house where it's an all Black community. And so I kind of lived in between two worlds all the time growing up. I didn't always feel comfortable in all the spaces where I was. And it wasn't until my grandmother moved to California, my brother and I used to go visit her every summer, because normally we stayed with my grandma. When she lived here, we were always with a lot of times we were with my grandma. When she moved, we could only be with her in the summers. Like, she allowed me that space for me to be me. Because I kind of had the experience of living in multiple places, as an adult, it really helped. Right? As a kid, I was always fighting because people would say things about my skin color and things like that. And I didn't take it lightly. And so I just always felt like militant and on edge. So when I was little, I used to have insecurities about my lips. Big lip Tamika. I mean, just all kinds of stuff. If there was a hangman and the kids were able to choose what the words were, sometimes they would say things about my lips on the hangman, and we're sitting here guessing A, B, and then it comes out to be something negative about me. So one day I had this epiphany that everybody's not against me. Just because they're white doesn't mean they're against me. And so I kind of had to go into this forgiveness phase. I had to like forgive myself for how I treated all of them as if they were the ones that had harmed me. And once I had done that, then it kind of freed me. But also, I learned a lot from that experience. What happens to you as a child just kind of makes you to who you are as an adult. It helped me to be more comfortable around all people.
Before Tamika decided to start her own brand, she worked at a big box makeup store where she witnessed quite a lot of racism. It was that experience that led her to create her own company.
There was a lot of times where I was the only Black woman on the floor. So I'm around all these huge companies, and then there's me. And because I have a passion for people, I didn't like selling, but I like people. The other young ladies were about their sales. They didn't care about the people. So their customer service wasn't very friendly. The people couldn't relax and let their hair down. So I ended up having the most sales. There was some young women on the floor that were making very terrible racial jokes, and then management kept having me follow Black women around the store to see if they were stealing. And so prior to me leaving the store, I said, you better get them, because what they're saying is not okay. So then COVID happened, we're furloughed, and then we had the civil unrest, the murder of George Floyd.
Today we learned that Minnesota's first confirmed case of COVID-19 coronavirus is here.
Over the past month, we've all been through a lot of changes.
We've adapted to our new normal and found that we really are stronger together.
And so all those things were happening at one time and we're all in the house. For me, I'm a creative person, so I needed to get busy with my hands because my anxiety was so elevated. I knew that I need to do something besides sit on the couch. I figured out how to make lipsticks, but all of them came out wrong. Some had a round curve when they came out the mold. Some were broken. I was like, I can't. It pushed me to figure out an alternative once my job called me and said, are you ready to come back to work? I said, have you dealt with the racism on the floor? They said, oh yeah, we're working on it. You're trying to pacify me. Don't do that. I understand you're not working on it. So I'm gonna go to a plan B for my own life. Everything just aligned and God opened the doors. And that's where I am now because this is where I'm supposed to be. Some people try to get places too fast and they end up missing steps. When you jump and you're jumping past steps, you can get rocked. Take the steps, don't rush it. Because it's a hard business, right? Business is hard in general, but having a beauty brand in Minnesota where there is no blueprint can be very difficult too. So I'm always trying to figure this whole thing out. And sometimes when I want to give up, I feel like a physical push, or that I'm standing taller because I'm standing on my grandma who was 4'9".
Thank you for listening. I'm honored to share Tamika Jones's voice. And in sharing her story, we give language to the most original way older women in our community share with us history. For KFI, this is Sundas Hassanoli.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org.
You can find and hear that story and everything you've heard here today again at Miniculture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. In fact, you can easily share the stories with your pals from there too, which I bet you are anxious to do. I know how you feel. This Miniculture work is made to be shared and get the word out about our unique and vibrant Minnesota community. The Miniculture SoundCloud page is a great way to keep tabs on their latest work. There and under the Miniculture tab on KFAI.org. And while you're there at KFAI.org, please consider hitting the donate button. You can help keep these great Miniculture stories coming by supporting KFAI Miniculture's radio home. Please do consider becoming a sustaining member of KFAI today. KFAI continues to operate with your support. It is truly people-powered public radio, and we need you now more than ever. This has been Miniculture Presents. My name is Michael Whetstone, and you are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members. And support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. I will be back here again next week, Monday, at 1 o'clock, with more great Miniculture stories as we continue our year in review for 2025. Until then, let's flip to the upside down. We'll be right back.